Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, our guest argues that there are much better ways of understanding the processes and politics of patronal systems. Then, how did the American media system become what it is today? And how have First Amendment rights changed? We'll trace the history in the debates that shaped it. While many in the West decry the politics of the former Soviet Union countries as corrupt and anti-democratic, our next guest argues that there are much better ways of understanding the processes and politics of patronal systems. Henry Hale is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs and co-director of the Program on New Approaches to Research and Security in Eurasia. He's the author of Why Not Parties in Russia? Democracy, Federalism, and the State, Developments in Russian Politics, and his latest, Patronal Politics. Welcome, Henry Hale. It's great to have you here on the Scholar's Circle. Your new book, Patronal Politics, you've essentially proposed this kind of new way of understanding events in the world that we have generally, in academia especially, called democratization, rising authoritarianism, or revolution. You think it's really actually part of a longer pattern. What are you getting at?
Yes, I think the general idea is that in countries where you have high levels of corruption, low rule of law, where so much of politics, as well, for that matter, as many other aspects of life, is about personal connections, who you know, that sort of thing, politics tends to work differently than it does in the West, for example. And I think that has big implications for the trajectories of countries in terms of their regime type and where they're going and patterns of politics. And so one of the broader conclusions is that when you have this sort of social environment where everything really depends on who you know and the personal connections and pressures that are put on individuals to vote a particular way through these personal connections or rewards that might be doled out on an individual basis, what you tend to get is a kind of cycling in politics. And so you get situations where when personal connections are important to power in order to have any resources or to have protection from others who might threaten you, there tends to be a rally around the leader type effect that tends to facilitate people who want to establish a more authoritarian form of rule, who want to quash their opponents. But at the same time, these sorts of systems, which might be compared to a giant political machine of the Boss Tweed variety, are vulnerable to, in particular, succession crises. So when people start thinking that this leader, this big patron, might be on his or her way out, then kind of all hell breaks loose. People start thinking about the future, trying to identify who the next patron will be, and trying to get on that person's side, or trying to become that person, or trying to prevent your rival from becoming that person. And so that leads to a breakdown. That's where I think you see a lot of the major revolutions in countries like this. So I focus on the former Soviet world. So we have the color revolutions that were largely described in media as being the products primarily of mass uprisings and democratic yearnings in the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, Rose Revolution in Georgia, Tulip Revolution in Kyrgyzstan. But I think these actually have much more to do with succession politics at the top. It opens up space for popular opinion to get expressed through these protests. And then the succession process gets played out. You get a new leader. But then almost inevitably, you start getting the same kind of reconsolidation of a more authoritarian system as all these people try to seek out their own personal connections with the people who have power and who have access to resources, because you can't rely on rule of law or independent courts to protect your interests. So you have to have this personal connection. And so the result is then a return back to more authoritarian rule until you have the next wave, the next succession crisis, which then tends to lead to more tensions. And I think the main way, in the short run at least, that in these countries can avoid this sort of cycling is to try and just maintain a high degree of popular support by trying to provide things that people genuinely want. When that tends to be the case, it reduces the fragmentation effect and gives leaders more control over the succession process. But even so, succession, is very fraught with risk for these leaders. So I think that's it in a nutshell in terms of what I think the core nature of many societies in the world, in particular in the former Soviet bloc, is, and some of the implications for how politics works and how we might understand it.
I wondered if, in fact, we're seeing a sort of continuum of patronal politics rather than one being, you know, absolutely patronal politics and another being not so much, like you said, Western societies, because some of those characteristics that you described, and you mentioned Bastweed, but some of them are still to some degree present in, say, U.S. politics. You know, who you know really matters. The role of money really matters. Personal favors for donors does occur. So would you put this on a spectrum across the world, or would you say one is distinct from the other system?
Absolutely. This is not a situation where you have some societies that are completely patronalistic, which is the term I use to describe these societies that, you know, have the low rule of law, high corruption, strong role for personal connections, and societies that are non-patronalistic. I use these concepts more as kind of ideal types in the sense that Max Weber described, sort of, you know, simplifications that illustrate a certain truth, even though no country is perfectly adherent to the type. So in this particular case, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, certainly I'm at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and I can see up close exactly how personal connections matter a lot in this town. But I think there are more generally some societies in which they just matter much, much more than they do in others, and matter to such a degree that they really overwhelm the presence of any kind of impartiality that might be present in, say, the court system or the rule of law. I would say that I think this situation where rulers rule by personal connections and people get things done through personal connections, you can think about it as the most natural way for government to be formed, going back to the original human communities where everybody did know each other. And then as societies expanded, governments expanded, that was the natural way for those rulers to start expanding their influence, was to work through people they knew, to kind of govern by, even when societies got too big for them to know everybody, they'd appoint their own personal representatives who would know the local people to rule themselves. And so I think the exceptions in world history have largely been those countries that have managed to some degree escape this. So, you know, that would be, you know, Western countries in particular, and, you know, some Asian countries now have made some progress in that regard. But again, none of them have completely escaped it. Again, in Washington, D.C., we still have political machines in many parts of the United States. And so this is not a completely either-or structure. But what I would suspect is that the countries where this matters the most, that are the most patronalistic, you'll start to see these most pronounced kinds of political swings and gyrations and real difficulties transitioning to a true liberal democracy with protection of rights. Whereas the other countries, you know, that have managed to escape this patronalism to at least some degree tend to have an easier time of it. And they've managed to make a political system that just works in a very different way. You know, when people feel more secure through the rule of law and through court systems, that they don't have to rely just on personal connections to protect themselves or to get anything done.
Perhaps one of the other distinguishing factors, say, from the West in some ways, are coercion and direct benefit that happens in these patronal systems. Would you say that's true? And if so, how would you describe how it works in the patronal system?
I think in societies, again, the ones that I have focused most on have been the former Soviet countries. The tendency is precisely to rule through these personal connections. And ideally, I think even for these rulers, I mean, they would like people to voluntarily go along with them and just to rely on rewards. But in practice, they tend to find it attractive as rulers to use some of these more coercive tools, right, which would be abuse of state organs for personal purposes. So it's very common in former Soviet states, as well as other parts of the world, of course, for rulers to rely on their secret services, their police organs, to repress individuals, to collect information about individuals that can then be used for blackmail, arresting opponents. They can use control over budgetary resources to squeeze people that they don't like. People that are challenging the regime might suddenly find their donors subjected to tax inspections and fire inspections and all kinds of licensing problems that might hinder their ability to do business. So there's just a whole range of these kinds of activities that, again, involve these very personalized, targeted punishments as well as rewards for the loyal that help bolster the ruler's power. And I find that one of the interesting things about these societies is you often get people who come to power, sometimes through revolution, sometimes otherwise, who seem genuinely to want to change the system. But oftentimes what they find is they face a lot of opposition, partly just because any leader is going to have some sort of opposition to whatever they're trying to do. They don't tend to like this opposition, so it just becomes too tempting to use these sorts of powers. I mean, I think of Mikhail Saakashvili in Georgia, who was Western educated, had a degree from Columbia, came to power in Georgia, topped the Rose Revolution. So I think he, like many other leaders, found it more attractive to try and use some of these powers for good, you know, for the sake of good reforms, in his view, than to forego them. But the result is that using them, they kind of generate their own reality and reconstitute some of these bad practices that then make a country more closed and a more authoritarian place. So after coming to power, he was able to reduce corruption in some areas, a truly dramatic reform of the police, the traffic police system in particular, which was notorious for bribe-taking, now is almost entirely clean. It's just a striking reform that even his enemies, politically and otherwise, acknowledge. But at the same time, within a couple of years of the revolution, he found himself taking control over opposition media, ordering police to crack down a few years after the Rose Revolution on a massive opposition protest, and otherwise putting the squeeze on opposition increasingly. So it just became a much more closed place than it had been after the revolution. And I think that's symptomatic. I think there are, you know, many other examples that one could find of rulers, just even ones that want to do good things, want to create democracy, want to reduce corruption, just find these patronalistic levers of power too useful or too attractive in their context, where everybody expects that they will, these levers will be used anyway, too attractive to forego.
You mentioned that it's expectation that drives this, because everybody expects this.
To a certain degree. In societies, part of the reason why patronal politics, as I've called it in the book, is so persistent over time is because if everybody is engaging in this kind of activity, right, if everybody thinks that in reality it's more about who you know than about who's right and or wrong, say, before the law, you don't expect the law to be impartially enforced, then there's just a very strong temptation and even a moral argument that people can make that they have to play by those same rules. Because if you're the only person that tries to behave honestly and everybody else doesn't, odds are good it's not going to be very good for you. And that may be okay for you personally, right, if you're willing to be the odd person out. But what if it also affects your family, if you're the person unable to bring home the bacon, right? If you have people who depend on you and the only way to get something done that would help you, you know, provide good things is to go through these personal connections and maybe pay a bribe to get something done, then people generally tend to find that they have to do it. And so when everybody expects everybody else to do it, it makes their own individual decision to do it much easier, whereas it could change entirely if they expected that everybody was going to play by a different set of rules. And I think that's one of the great achievements of Western societies, is that it's been accomplished that most people expect other people not to blatantly subvert the law. And when people do that, you know, which they do continue to try, right? We still have corruption cases. There's a widespread feeling that, you know, risk that people might be caught or that this is just morally wrong. So there's enough of this expectation that this is not going to succeed that the behavior often gets caught and actually punished.
Let's turn to elections. I loved how you said this in the first part of the book. Elections are civil wars fought by nonviolent means. The opposite of what other political scientists have said about politics.
Right.
How is this the case?
I think on one hand, we tend to think, especially in Western societies, democracy sort of as what in the American context we think of as the New England town meeting, where we have citizens coming together and voicing different views, and then the broader public decides one way or other. You know, whereas in fact, I think in a lot of history, including much of the history of the United States, what we've seen is that elections are the arena not simply for a hashing out of views, but for a competition of different political forces, because especially when you get a society that's more than just, again, a small town where everybody can know each other and actually hear each other's views, somehow all the views that exist in society have to get aggregated and hashed out, and it's impossible for everybody's ideas to get heard. And so then which ideas do get heard and which don't? Well, that's a situation that involves resources and power. Who can get their ideas onto the agenda, get their ideas voted on, get their ideas heard by the population? And then you have the situation where in order to decide, what matters really is a turnout issue. How can you get your voters to the ballot box? Even in Western societies, right, that's an issue, and it's a situation that makes the administrative apparatus very important. Parties in the United States that can mobilize turnout, right, that can provide the buses and have the call centers to, you know, mobilize their supporters or physically bring them to the polls matters a lot. But in paternalistic societies, this just the paternalistic power aspect of it just becomes much more important, and it just becomes a much more organized battle that starts to blend over into the coercive or even sometimes violent. And so I think that's why if civil war is kind of the most violent way of resolving a political conflict within a country, completely devoid of rational debate over issues, elections are sort of the most peaceful way. In paternalistic societies, again, where I think rule of law is not completely absent, but it's not reliable, you start getting these battles which are both the battles for hearts and minds, but they're also very much a battle of political machines, which means trying to suppress other voices, trying to project your own voice. And for the strongest political machines, of course, they can pretty much squelch other voices. And in the most extreme cases, actually force the voters out, really. So you're just falsifying results. But I think what's interesting is even in those societies where it's not a complete dictatorship or a monarchy, what formally decides the result of the battle is that you have to get an official election result somehow. And even a completely falsified election result is not easy to achieve. It's something that has to be mobilized. You have to have a huge administrative apparatus that's capable of organizing it, suppressing popular opposition, manipulating the party system in ways that is going to facilitate that. And so even that completely engineered election is a kind of Herculean administrative defeat that kind of resembles the movement of a large army to try and achieve its goals. And so they might not have to fire on the opposition side. They might not have to mow them down in organized battles. But there is that coercive element there. I mean, that would be another case where I think there is sort of a continuum in the level of coercion that's involved in the electoral process. And many of the countries of the world are kind of in that area in between, that kind of, some scholars have called it a gray area or a kind of twilight zone where, you do have some battle for real ideas, but a lot of the battle is a battle of these political machines.
You also wrote about a formal versus an informal kind of politics. How do you distinguish this informal aspect?
Well, when you talk about formal politics, I mean, formal politics is generally, the politics that are completely according to the way that laws appear on paper, the ways that they're formalized in legislation, if all law is perfectly obeyed. Informal politics is sort of the politics of the wink, of the mutual understanding that's concluded. And sometimes these unwritten rules, these informal rules, can be very developed and elaborate. Like mafia groups are a classic example of kind of informal politics governing them, right? I mean, there's a clear hierarchical structure. Everybody understands how it works, or if you don't understand, you're eliminated pretty quickly, or you're brought into line. But none of that is actually written down. And so informal politics then, I think, is this kind of whole realm of politics that it works through these types of understandings. And so in most countries, highly paternalistic countries, again, like the former Soviet Union, you have some role for formal politics. I mean, there are laws that are passed, laws that are enforced by the police. But then so much of politics occurs off the books, so much that you can't even really understand how politics works if you don't understand the informal aspects, the unwritten rules of the game, who needs to be acknowledged when, what kinds of resources the different powers have, right? So, oligarchs, for example, these politically active business people, right, that can control massive corporate conglomerates, they have a very explicit political role in systems, for example, like Vladimir Putin. So, you know, they're not in the government. They have no formal constitutional role. But they understand that in order to keep their business opportunities alive, they have to not run afoul, at a minimum, of Putin and perhaps better please him. And so they serve these roles of providing money and channeling money to forces that tend to work for the Kremlin, stifling financial opportunities of parties or individuals who might be, you know, doing things that the government doesn't like. And so, again, you know, that's an example of an informal political role, but this very important for understanding how the larger political system works. So, you know, Russia's political system is not like they just passed a law saying all opposition are banned. You know, there's no such law. But there's an informal understanding that those groups that do openly challenge the Kremlin are going to have a very hard time, you know, in business, raising money, doing almost anything that they want to do, at least, you know, if these opposition forces are serious enough, the Kremlin is concerned about them. If they're just small fry, you know, they may just leave them alone.
We will continue next week with Henry Hale. Henry Hale is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs and co-director of the Program on New Approaches to Research and Security in Eurasia. He's the author of Patronal Politics. When we come back, how did the American media system become what it is today? Stay tuned.
We want to see our world in one piece.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guest traces the history of American media, particularly in the crucial period of the 1940s and 1950s, when citizens and political leaders held vigorous debates about how media could best serve the public. What happened to lead us to where we are today? We're joined by Victor Picard. He's a professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communication, the author of America's Battle for Media Democracy, and co-author of Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? Welcome, Victor Picard. It's great to have you back here on the Scholar Circle.
Thanks for having me on the show, Maria.
Terrific book about how we got here to the current media environment in the USA, but also seems to be followed by other countries. So we're taught that it is objective. You argue that the subjectivity has a purpose in itself. It's not value-free. How would you describe this, and how did it come about?
This notion that the news should remain objective, the objectivity norm, is kind of exhibit A for the professionalization of the press, the American press in particular, because this is a kind of an American-specific norm. I don't think it necessarily translates to other media systems. But what I try to show in my book is that in many ways this presumably value-free media, news media system, is actually shot through with commercial values, that it actually is biased in a particular way, in a structural way, and to understand that you need to look at how our media system is designed and the commercial imperatives that drive it.
How did this come about? You focus on the 1940s as the significant period. What was happening then?
So in the 1940s, you might say then as now, there was a raging policy battle over the nature of the media system, which in the 40s was primarily radio. I also talk a lot about print media and newspapers as well. But there was a lot of concern about what the role of radio should be in a democratic society. A lot of people at that time were concerned that radio was not living up to its democratic promise. Much of the rhetoric that you heard then, similar to what you hear today about the internet, this new media was supposed to democratize society. It was supposed to revolutionize the way we talk about important social issues. And in many ways, it simply wasn't living up to those expectations. So you saw a period where various constituencies, but also just the public writ large, were concerned about the direction of radio, and they were basically trying to intervene in different ways to reshape the system.
That was the time when, say, the FCC was formed, and there were some antitrust rulings, there was some discussion about public service responsibilities. Let's discuss some of these, maybe starting with the FCC, the Communications Commission, how it came about, and what its mission was at that time.
So the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, which is the main regulatory body that has oversight over much of our media system, particularly broadcast media and telecommunications, it was founded with the 1934 Communications Act. And even though it started during the New Deal era, it initially began with somewhat of a backwater agency. It wasn't very ambitious or aggressive in regulating those industries under its purview, although there was a somewhat aggressive study of AT&T in the late 1930s. But it wasn't until the early 40s, late 30s, but especially early 40s, with the arrival of James Lawrence Fly, better known as Larry Fly, who was this tough liberal from Texas who was a veteran of a lot of anti-monopoly battles throughout the 30s. And one of the first things that he did when he became chairman of the FCC was start to go after these radio monopolies, especially NBC. It's difficult to imagine this happening today, but Larry Fly essentially trust-busted NBC, or at least he forced NBC to divest itself of one of its major networks, which is actually how we got ABC. So they were very aggressive. It would be like Tom Wheeler today breaking up Verizon or Comcast. It's really kind of beyond our comprehension, but it was something that the FCC was doing in the 40s. They were also preventing newspapers from rapidly buying up radio stations. And as you noted, they eventually pivoted to focus on public service responsibilities as well.
And how has it evolved now, the FCC? How would you say from that point it's become what it is today?
There's a long history there. One thing that was unique to the 1940s was that you had this very rare progressive bloc on the commission. At that time, there were seven commissioners instead of the five that you have today. And four of the seven were at least liberal-leaning. And I don't think you've really had that configuration again since that time. So that's one major difference. I chart this in my book, the long history of the FCC, and there were moments where there were individuals, most recently you had Michael Copps at the FCC, who were able to advance progressive initiatives here and there, but never able to really push forward like they were in the 40s. And some people would argue today, the economists refer to this as regulatory capture, this notion of when regulatory bodies essentially internalize the value systems and the logics of the industries that they're meant to regulate. And some people would say that our current FCC qualifies or at least suffers from some degree of regulatory capture. Just to give one example, people hear about the revolving door phenomenon. And one study shows that since 1980, 20 of the 26 former commissioners and chairs of the FCC have gone to work for the industries that they previously regulated. So I think that's one indication that there's a very cozy relationship now between regulators and industry.
And it seems to have become considerably weaker since this time when there was some trust busting going on.
Absolutely, especially in terms of public interest obligations. One major initiative that many people have at least probably heard of that came out of the 40s was the Fairness Doctrine. This is the last big policy battle of that decade. And there's a bit of historical irony involved because today, at least among progressives, the Fairness Doctrine is often held up as this pinnacle of enlightened media policy. But in the 40s, it was anything but. It was seen as a kind of derivative consolation prize for stronger regulations that the Fairness Doctrine had replaced. And even though from that point forward, at least for the ensuing decades until 1987, when Ronald Reagan's FCC repealed the Fairness Doctrine, it was used to varying degrees of success by activists on the left and the right, but in many ways it was treating the symptoms of bigger fundamental problems with our commercial media system. So I think that's one example where there's been this gradual erosion from structural reform efforts.
The Fairness Doctrine actually had a predecessor. What was that called?
Yes, it replaced the all but forgotten Mayflower Doctrine, and that was something that was implemented in 1941 under Larry Fly when he was still the chairman at the FCC, and it basically prohibited broadcasters from politically editorializing, which sounds quite severe, but at the time it was assumed that since you were, especially in the early 40s, you're really talking about a duopoly. CBS and NBC were the two largest players. They dominated disproportionate amount of the, and I should underscore this, the public airwaves. And so it was assumed to give them the kind of political power that they would have if they were to editorialize was simply dangerous to have in a democratic society. That was one of the stronger regulations that they were preventing, but that the Fairness Doctrine replaced, but also just this idea that you need to break up the ownership of media, that you shouldn't have concentrated control. I think that's something that was being eroded throughout the 40s and really for the last 60 or 70 years in terms of regulatory reform.
During this time, you had noted this rich flow of ideas, but at a certain point, it seems from your book that the window closed and reform was off limits. What, in your assessment, closed that window?
This period in the 40s, historians sometimes refer to these moments as critical junctures, and they tend to happen when there's political, social, and technological change all happening simultaneously. What you were seeing, and of course a number of things were happening in the 40s, you had World War II, it was a major event, you had the New Deal agenda, which even though it was in various degrees of retreat throughout much of government, social movements at that time in the 40s hadn't gotten the memo that the period of reform had closed, and actually you saw a spike in various forms of activism, especially around civil rights and around labor-related activism. Unions were really on the march at this time. These activist groups realized that they needed to change the media system, and in order to change the system, they really had to change media policy itself. So I think these were some of the elements. You also had the rise of FM radio. This is this kind of technological change happening. And you also just had widespread, at least in varying degrees, you had public disgust towards what was happening with commercial radio, especially the proliferation of radio advertisements, which many people were upset about.
Now, also at this time, the Supreme Court's decisions around free speech, free press, First Amendment were understood not just as the media's right, but as a right to information on the citizen side. How did this then become understood as sort of the privilege of just the media, and particularly the corporate media?
Yes, this was a major battle happening at this time. And really, there was this kind of ideological consolidation, what I refer to as corporate libertarianism, that redefined or at least shifted the understanding. I think it was a little bit up in the air at this point in the 40s about how the First Amendment should be understood with regards to our media. And what came out of this decade was this assumption that corporations in general, but media corporations specifically, have individual rights. They have First Amendment rights, and that those that their First Amendment rights trump the rights of others, including local communities, various groups, and society writ large. And I think that you see this being fought out in a number of debates. In many ways, they were able to prevail. Certainly, this logic, this corporate libertarian logic, triumphed. But as you noted, there were also Supreme Court decisions that were pushing in the opposite direction, that were saying that it's the rights of the audience, of the public, that are paramount, more sort of these collective First Amendment rights, also these kind of positive freedoms, freedoms of access, for example. So you're really seeing this, these oppositional views fighting it out throughout the 40s. But I think we inherited the libertarian view, and that's one that we're still grappling with today.
And at the same time, you noted that this was when it also became incorporated into the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But it was adopted with the wider meaning rather than just the libertarian meaning.
That's right. So one way of understanding this is positive versus negative rights. And the idea that negative rights are protecting us from things, usually it's assumed, at least in the United States context, that it's protecting us from government. But there's also these positive rights, freedom to or freedom for. And to use the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as an example, Article 19 really enshrines some of these positive rights, what are sometimes referred to as communication rights or the right to communicate. I do think it is this more social democratic vision that you see glimmers of throughout the 1940s. It's an alternative system, and again, one that really privileges the rights of access, the rights of the community over corporations.
One of the things that really silenced some of these debates about structure and ownership that you mentioned in the book was a purge of particular activists who were questioning and driving debates. What happened in this purge? Are you speaking of the purges during the Red Scare?
That's right. I think we are still only today beginning to understand the extent to which the Red Scare really put down this social democratic vision, social democratic challenge to the libertarianism that prevailed. And you saw elements of this in different areas. For example, on the airwaves, you saw a purge of liberal commentators. That was one of the main critiques that drove the media reform movement throughout the 1940s. But more broadly, you saw reformers being stigmatized as supposedly belonging to some sort of socialistic plot. They were dismissed as communist. No matter how reasonable or innocuous the government policy might be in other contexts, it was easily dismissed as being this sort of statist attempt for government to take over the media system. And I think that the Red Scare sort of did the work of advancing this argument that government had no legitimate role to intervene in markets in general, but media markets specifically. And that's really the legacy that we've inherited from these debates in the 1940s.
It sounds a lot like today's Fox News and Rush Limbaugh.
That's right. I think you see that really being pronounced and articulated in those venues. But also when you hear somewhat crazy things like corporations are people, you know, this assumption that private property rights are rights that should be held above all other kinds of liberties. Back in the 40s, this still was not crystallized. I think I'm trying to trace these arguments, these logics back to their origins. And I do think that this is when it's really starting to consolidate this ideological position that now many people just treat as the natural state of things.
So remind us of some of the purges that happened. You mentioned the firing of the Hollywood 10. Who were they?
Oh, well, that's something I just vaguely just touch on in my book. And I think people are more familiar with the Red Scare and its effect on Hollywood, which, you know, there were union battles going on at this time. There were directors who were advancing social justice themes in various films. And so there's this real cultural battle happening in Hollywood, but it was also happening all across the United States at this time through social movement groups and also just social democratic bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. And so, for example, I focus on Clifford Durr, who was an FCC commissioner who was involved in a number of reform initiatives. And he was not only red-baited, but blacklisted and had a very difficult time. He essentially left D.C. because he refused to force his employees to sign the loyalty oaths that were being instituted at this time. He had a very difficult time ever getting a job again after leaving D.C. So I think this Red Scare just demobilized a generation of activists and social democratic reformers and had a tremendous impact on American society and specifically how America's media system developed.
as a history repeats itself lesson, only slightly different, particularly now with the internet. The debate for net neutrality, there's a great big debate about who should control the internet and should it be a free Wild West. And it seems like the same types of arguments occurring. How would you compare them?
So again, today, I feel like we're having another one of these moments where a kind of social contract is being fought over. Basically, the relationships between those who own the communication infrastructures and the FCC and the public, or at least the public interest is at stake. And you do see a lot of similar rhetoric. In fact, you've even seen things where conservative activists have tried to brand net neutrality as a fairness doctrine for the internet, which is actually not correct at all. It's not a very good parallel. But you do see similar rhetoric being thrown around. And I think we're at one of those critical moments where these policy decisions can determine the trajectory of, in this case, the internet for decades to come. So the stakes could not be higher.
In fact, I think you even called it something like a death blow. How is this a mortal blow if it goes the way of the 1950s?
First of all, in general, if the FCC were to lose regulatory control of broadband, then we would be entirely at the mercy of the monopolies or the duopolies that control, especially our internet services. So, for example, Comcast, Time Warner, Verizon. There's just a handful of corporations that really dominate the internet service market. But in specifically talking about net neutrality, which is just this basic democratic idea that all content online should be treated equally, that your internet service provider shouldn't be able to slow down content or block particular websites. If we were to lose that safeguard, that protection, it would fundamentally change the nature of the internet. So that would have a tremendous impact on our everyday lives, potentially. I think it's both the specific battle of net neutrality is a very important one, but there's also this broader issue about having control over our media infrastructures.
You're concerned also that if they block or privilege certain content, what is it that you think that we would get?
Some people have likened it to creating a cable television model for the internet, where you would have fast and slow lanes, you might have premium content for which you have to pay extra for. It would just change everything. When people hear this, they're generally not in favor of losing net neutrality. In fact, you saw nearly 4 million people write to the FCC, the overwhelming majorities, by some estimates, 99% of which were all in favor of net neutrality. I would also argue that this really is only the first step to what should be a larger struggle. In many ways, net neutrality is a kind of secondary problem. And the bigger problem is that we're dealing with these massive corporate monopolies who have tremendous market power. And so I think that's something that we really need to focus on.
One of the other debates that you noted that was going on back in the 40s that is parallel today has to do with this idea that the media should be completely self-regulatory. I think you called it the social responsibility model. And that government should keep out. But as you rightly point out, the government has a role at all times. It's just, what is that role? How would you describe this?
You're absolutely right. So it's a fallacy that the government stays out of media. The government is always implicated in media. We can point to so many different examples. It's just that usually it's not in favor or it's not in protection of the public interest. Instead, you have things like giveaways of the public airwaves to basically corporations who have monopolistic use, who are able to make tremendous profits from that public resource. You also have copyright. Despite all the rhetoric you hear of corporations being anti-regulation, that's seen as a good regulation because it often benefits corporations' profit imperatives. So that's one contradiction. But you're right, it really comes down to how should the media be regulated? And I think those are the debates, these power struggles over how our infrastructure, our media infrastructure is governed. That's what was happening in the 40s, and that's what's happening again today. But this self-regulation, this corporate libertarian paradigm, is still dominant, and that's something that we will have to change in order to advance meaningful reform.
You have argued that there are some serious dangers to this libertarian approach. We've seen some limitations to the public debate as a result of this. What are some of the other concerns that you have?
Well, there are a number of concrete concerns. I mean, there's always going to be debate about what is the relationship between media content and the media structures. But some things that you can point to that I think are beyond controversy is this idea of the digital divide. And it sounds like something from the 1990s, but even today in the U.S., something like a third or nearly a third of U.S. households lack access to broadband internet services. So that's a major problem. Also, just the overall lack of competition. Again, despite the surface level appearance of having access to all these channels and websites, when you get beyond that surface, it's actually dominated by a relative handful of corporations. So these are the concerns. The last, perhaps the biggest concern, is to the degree that our public media system is impoverished in the United States. We're a global outlier for how little we pay for our public media. And I think that's something that we really need to try to change, to have a public alternative to the commercial media system.
You noted that in the 1940s, the public was much more knowledgeable and engaged than today. Do you see a relationship to media and media content there?
Well, I do, but I would also nuance this idea that it does seem that the public is more engaged around media policy issues in the 1940s. But I would also, again, point to the 4 million people who wrote to the FCC about this wonky-sounding thing called net neutrality. So I think that it's fair to say that even today, the public does engage. If people understand what the stakes are, and if they can see that media policies are being made not just in their name, but also with their consent, I think you can see public engagement, again, in a very significant way. I'm cautiously optimistic that that's still true today.
After the demise of the Fairness Doctrine, we saw the rise of all of these radio programs with shock jock kind of hosts and much more of a strident, one-sided argument on things like Fox News. And there's a bit of a debate now about whether that has contributed to the polarization of the American public and American politicians, or whether that was actually following the polarization that was occurring. Where do you stand in that argument?
I agree that there is a kind of chicken and egg relationship here. It certainly seems to me, impressionistically, there's been a shrilling of political and media discourse. And I think that must be bound up in what's happened with the rise of partisan news outlets, particularly media like right-wing talk radio, for example. I wouldn't feel comfortable to draw a strong causal link. I would agree, though, that these are problems, and whether the Fairness Doctrine is the best way to address that, I tend to think not. I tend to think that even though the Fairness Doctrine was a very admirable attempt and was useful in some ways, that we really should be trying to make these structural changes to try to create public alternatives to the commercial media system.
And what are some of the ways that we can do that? What are some ideas that you have?
Well, in the conclusion of my book, I run through a number of them, but just a couple fairly obvious ones. Again, going back to this idea that we need to fund our public media system in the United States much more adequately than we do today. Today, Americans pay something like $1.50 per year for their public media, and that pales in comparison to citizens in pretty much all other democratic countries. So that's something we need to change. We should try to see more community and municipal-owned and operated broadband networks. This is actually something that President Obama has come out in favor for. We might see some movement in that direction. And also just for the future, journalism, we need to see more nonprofit newspapers and try to create low-profit or non-commercial news media outlets. And this is going to be a struggle, but I think that we need to do it for the sake of democracy.
How to fund the nonprofit models? As you know, this program airs on a whole series of nonprofit radio stations, but they're all struggling pretty desperately. What do you suggest?
Yes, so that's an important question. And I should note that Pacifica was one of the shining exemplars in terms of structural alternatives that came out of the 40s. But beyond just being dependent on your listeners for support, I think we need to find ways to subsidize media. And for many Americans, this is a difficult pill to swallow. But I think whether we force commercial broadcasters to pay money for their monopolistic use of the public airwaves, whether we try to convert public infrastructure, so for example, post offices and public libraries to create community media centers. There are also a number of very innovative ideas like tax vouchers, for example, where individuals are able to put a certain amount of money towards the media of their choice. There are ways to do it. It will take the political will for it to happen.
One of the other issues that you discussed was the relationship that could evolve between media and the government and having government have some sort of a check. And you mentioned the BBC. I couldn't quite tell whether you were advocating for a BBC model or a modified version. But one of the big issues with the BBC was that whenever the country was in conflict, it was strongly controlled by the government. One example was the broadcasting ban on terrorists, so that the Sinn Féin, who were elected members of the parliament, were not allowed to have their voices on the air. How would you prevent something like that if you had some kind of government regulation?
The BBC is certainly not a perfect model, although when I hear about its problems, I kind of think I'd like to have those problems in the United States. But I think that question about keeping safeguards and firewalls between government and public media has to be of the highest priority. Although I think, in fact, there are studies showing this, that British media and public media in general tend to be more adversarial towards those in power than, say, for example, American privately owned commercial newspapers. But I think that your question is spot on. We would have to make sure that any sort of subsidy is ideologically and content neutral. It just cannot be allowed to, it has to be an indirect and very targeted subsidy, and it cannot be allowed to dictate media content.
I just don't know where you draw those lines when you have them, when you get started down that path. And it's a big question. I feel like your arguments are really for democratization of media in some way, which in principle I'm strongly supportive of. And then I stop and I think democracy has produced the politicians that we have today who have created this media that we both think is inadequate. So it's a quandary. What are your thoughts on this pros and cons of democratization of our media?
Well, I think that oftentimes it gets framed as either big government control of media or big corporation control of media. And there's a third way that we don't hear about often enough, which is this idea of local community control of media. And I think there you really can have democratization of the media. In fact, there was this public interest policy that got removed in the 1980s, along with so many others, like the Fairness Doctrine. It was known as ascertainment. And one of the things that commercial broadcasters had to do in order to hold on to their licenses was to go into local communities and ascertain, what did those communities want to hear covered on the public airwaves? What sort of issues would they like to hear discussed? And so that's just one example, but I think that sort of, that principle of local control is an important one, and one that we really should try to defend and advance in our media policy.
And this idea of public airwaves, where did that actually come from? And what does it mean today?
Well, this slogan that the air belongs to the people, it sounds like just that, a slogan, but it was true in the 1930s and 40s, and it's still very much true today. It's based on this public trustee model, this idea that the broadcasters only lease those airwaves. It is a public resource just as much as public parks are, and that it's assumed that there is a purpose for this public resource. There's also a scarcity issue as well, that not everyone has the means to create to have a radio station, for example. So there is this social contract, and it should be, it is inherently contentious, But we could have inherited a very different media system had these debates gone differently in the 1940s.
What are merit goods?
Yes, an economic term that I discuss in the conclusion of my book. It's very similar to a public good, but this notion that there are things, there are services and systems that a society requires, but that the market will not support. Public education is a great example of that. But I argue in my book that media, that news media in particular, are one such a type of a merit good that produces tremendous positive externalities that the market can never support sufficiently. So we have to create public means to support this, to subsidize it, in other words. And it's straight out of neoclassical economics, but it's something that's just very rarely discussed in the American political discourse today.
This has nothing to do with your book, Clay, but I was just curious about your thoughts on this group Freedom House.
So you're referring to the group that does surveys on like how democratic countries are, and am I correct?
Well, they particularly look at how free the media are, meaning how much control governments have on them for the most part.
That's right. So, I mean, in my view, and of course, it's not something I discuss in my book, but my understanding is that they find that actually subsidized countries have very free, and in other words, countries that subsidize their media systems tend to be very democratic, and that there's actually a correlation there. There are similar studies, actually, as a side note, that demonstrate this, that in fact, countries with strong public media systems tend to have better informed, better engaged citizens around particular issues, especially international issues. So this goes beyond speculation and polemics, and we now actually have empirical evidence to suggest that the public media systems are good for democracy.
Well, Victor Picard, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me back on the show, Maria. I really enjoyed it.
Victor Picard is a professor of communication at the Annenberg School of Communication. He's the author of America's Battle for Media Democracy and co-author of With the Last Reporter, Please Turn Out the Lights. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.